Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, while testing for COVID-19 remains an issue around Colorado, San Miguel County has partnered with a biomedical company and is offering free COVID-19 antibody blood testing to all residents in the county. The testing started in March. It'll run through the end of this month, and a key group in this effort has been the community members who are volunteering to do everything from greeting people to directing traffic to even drawing blood. We'll hear how that volunteer effort came together and what other regions which might have to mobilise similar volunteer efforts as COVID-19 spreads could learn. Then, while the vast majority of people who get COVID-19 recover without ever going to a hospital, some people do die. And what's more, the risk of contagion from the virus is changing the dying process for everyone in hospitals and care facilities. We'll hear from a local hospice about what that looks like. Then, in addition to hoarding toilet paper, it seems that Coloradoans are also hoarding guns and ammunition. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation reports an increase of nearly 90% in requests for background checks for gun purchases. Now, this is leading to delays in turning those checks around. Under federal law, checks must be done within 3 business days. But with the current delay, it means that firearm dealers can legally sell a gun to someone without clearing a background check. We'll hear from Colorado Ceasefire, a gun control advocacy group, who last Friday wrote a letter to Governor Polis asking him to intervene in this situation. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, we'll take a look at how COVID-19 is impacting local law enforcement. KGNU's Richard Kiefer speaks with Boulder County Sheriff Joe Pelle and Boulder District Attorney Michael Doherty. At 9 o'clock, we'll get media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
On Sunday, Colorado health officials finalized guidelines about who should receive care, including ventilators, if a surge of coronavirus patients overwhelms hospitals. The guidelines provide that triage teams with 4 members would make decisions. The triage teams would comprise an ethics or palliative care expert, a critical care doctor, a nurse, and a hospital leader. Those teams would not include a patient's immediate medical caregivers. The Denver Post reports that the teams will rank patients based upon a combination of severity of their symptoms, any chronic illness, and how long they're likely to survive. If some patients rank equally, then care would be prioritized for children, healthcare workers, and first responders. Then the teams would weigh whether patients were pregnant or sole caregivers and how many years of life could be saved. Jill Hunsaker Ryan, director of the State Department of Public Health and Environment, said that they hope they don't have to use the crisis of care standards, but she added that COVID-19 has been spreading quickly and it could overwhelm the hospital system and intensive care units. Yesterday, state officials also made public the projections of possible infections, hospitalizations, and deaths from the virus that have been given to the governor. The projections vary significantly. If people don't engage in physical distancing, there could be as many as 33,000 deaths by June 1st. But alternatively, fatalities could reach less than 400 by that date should social distancing be maintained. Projected infections range from a high of nearly 1 million by May 7th or a low of about 40,000 by November, again, depending on distancing measures. Officials said that they are using the projections to guide their decision-making. The team making those projections includes experts from CU School of Medicine, CU Boulder, and CU Denver. As of yesterday, the coronavirus had claimed the lives of 140 people in the state, about 3 times that of a week ago. Nearly 5,000 people had been confirmed to have the disease, but health officials estimate 4 to 10 times that amount have actually been infected. As of Sunday, more than 900 have been hospitalized. In Boulder County, officials said yesterday that a 4th person had died due to complications from the virus, with the total number of cases in the county at 160. 75 people in Boulder County who tested positive have recovered. Boulder County officials also are supporting the governor's call for all Coloradoans to wear non-medical face masks when leaving homes for essential business. They stress that wearing a mask is not a replacement for staying home and continuing to stay 6 feet away from others. RTD is making some changes in light of the COVID-19 pandemic, including canceling all fares. Henry Schuyler has more.
As fare collecting is done at the front of all buses, the move comes along with rear access loading for most passengers. Passengers will be able to board from the back of the bus without paying and should all be sitting at least 6 feet apart. This will remove most of the contact between drivers and riders, although passengers with wheelchairs will still have to use the front of the bus. RTD is also canceling the 16th Street free mall ride and the free metro rides in Denver. The agency is also implementing a plan to compensate pass holders who have already purchased tickets. The fares suspension will be across all rider systems as to not discriminate against any rider group. RTD will be reducing a majority of its routes starting on April 19th. For KGNU, I'm Henry Schuyler.
Aurora City Council members will meet virtually today to discuss a resolution that would urge detention centers to implement policies to limit the spread of COVID-19. The Sentinel reports that the proposed measures would encourage detention facilities to publicly disclose how many cases have been confirmed in a facility. It would also encourage the authorities to examine people for symptoms before entering and increase the number and length of telephone and video visitations. Families of inmates would have to be informed about actions like quarantine. The resolution would be aimed at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Facility in Aurora and local jails. The council's consideration of the resolution comes after a protest was held at the Immigration Detention Facility on Friday. Dozens of cars outfitted with signs and messages about freeing detained immigrants circled the center. One sign on a car read, "I want my dad free and healthy." And another said, "Free them now." The group known as Abolish ICE said in a release that their actions would escalate until every person in the detention center is released. On Friday, Colorado criminal defense lawyers filed a petition with the state Supreme Court asking it to intervene and create standard rules aimed at decreasing the number of people locked up and preventing the spread of the virus in courts. The petition describes condition in jails, saying that vomiting inmates are preparing food for hundreds. Jail phones have not been sanitized after each use, and deputies are not changing protective gloves as they interact with dozens of people. The Denver Post reports that the petition was filed 2 days after an El Paso County sheriff deputy at the jail died from the virus. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has suspended many court operations, but has left it to each of the state's 22 judicial districts to make their own decisions on how to address the virus. His order has not addressed the jails. The High Court could consider the defense lawyer's request or reject it. On Friday, the Colorado Secretary of State's office said that backers of a proposal to ban abortions at 22 weeks had failed to collect enough signatures to put the measure on the November ballot. The Denver Post reports that the group behind the initiative has an additional 15 days to collect signatures once a statewide shelter-in-place order is lifted. A judge's decision last week granted the added time. The number of petitions turned in by the group was about 10,000 less than required. In today's weather, it will be sunny with a high about 73 and windy in the morning. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 69 and breezy. Right now, it's about 45. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 12 minutes past 8 o'clock. A biomedical company has partnered with San Miguel County in southwest Colorado to offer free COVID-19 antibody blood testing to anyone in the county who wants it. The testing started last month and it will run through the end of April. So far, the work has run smoothly, but it would have been much harder without some key community members. Matt Hoish reports from Telluride.
Over the last week, San Miguel County has drawn blood to test thousands of people for COVID-19 antibodies. This effort came together in a matter of days through a public-private partnership between the county and United Biomedical, the company providing the tests. But the testing would not have run as efficiently as it has without another piece of the puzzle, an army of volunteers from the community stepping up to do everything, from directing traffic to handing out carefully labeled test kits to drawing the blood. Lynn Borup is the executive director of Tri-County Health Network, the local nonprofit that the county tapped to organize the volunteers.
No, I've been really surprised, and quite honestly, daily more people are signing up to volunteer, and it's been amazing to me, and I think that's one of the benefits.
Susan Lilly, public information officer for the county, notes that the county initially put in a request for the National Guard to help with testing, but they were not available. So, she says, the county developed a plan to use volunteers. They reached out to Tri-County in the hopes of tapping one central group to handle the volunteer outreach and coordination. Tri-County already works with citizens across the area on issues like food security, insurance, and energy. Borup says the nonprofit has been able to use that pre-existing trust and network of contacts to quickly enlist and mobilize volunteers.
Some folks are not really keen on government agencies, and so sometimes we found if the local governments take the lead in things like this, that people kind of back away a little bit, just depending on their own biases. Knowing that it's Tri-County and knowing that we may have helped that person in the past, they always want to give back. And so they're really happy to outreach to us and feel comfortable and safe that their information is really going to be used for the purposes that it's for just volunteering.
Trust has been especially key considering the fact that decisions on how and when volunteers will help have changed day by day.
I'm emailing people at 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night for the next day. And with stuff like that, it really shows how amazing our community is because people are responding and they're getting there the next day at 8:30 when I emailed them not even 10 hours earlier.
That's Sammy Damski. Normally, she is the Behavioral Health Outreach Coordinator for Tri-County Health. But for now, she is in charge of organizing and directing the more than 60 volunteers per day that do everything except draw blood. On the east end of the county, that organizing falls to Emil Sante, chief paramedic for the Telluride Fire Protection District and the county coroner. Sante says he has about 50 volunteers who can take shifts to draw blood. A lot of them, he says, are nurses or EMTs who already serve medical needs daily. He's also gotten requests from people with experience but who haven't drawn blood in years.
Let's dust you off and put you with somebody who's real experienced, and after an hour or two of being lobbed some softballs here, we'll take the training wheels off and you're on your own. And it's been pretty gratifying. Some of these people that have come out who haven't done this in a while, you can see it in their face. They're really having a good time.
The county also has a significant immigrant population. Nuria Galipienso is one of several people who volunteered as a translator, helping Spanish-speaking community members navigate the testing. She worked in the area temporarily as a teacher years earlier, but moved from Spain to Telluride permanently last year.
And they have gave me so many things. It's been for me so easy to get adapted here. So in some way, I was thinking I need to give something back to the community too.
As COVID-19 continues to spread, there's a good chance other communities will need to mobilize similar volunteer efforts in one way or another. Lynn Borup says some of the major lessons from San Miguel's efforts have been that it's important to have one central place for people to sign up, and it's key to have a good system for figuring out availability and scheduling. But at the end of the day, it's also all about being flexible and collaborative. Sammy Damski says it's amazing to see so many people from so many different sectors and organizations that are normally separate come together.
This kind of is more like, yeah, we're all just doing this.
Yeah, we're all just doing this. In Telluride, I'm Matt Hoisch.
Well, the vast majority of people who get COVID-19 will recover without ever having to go to a hospital. Some people will not have that outcome. And as we are hearing, some people are dying. Well, what's more, the risk of contagion from COVID-19 is changing the dying process for everyone in hospitals and care facilities. Headlines around the world are putting it this way. As hospitals restrict visitors, patients die in a medical version of solitary confinement. Well, local hospices are working hard to help COVID-19 patients and their families have a more compassionate end-of-life experience. To learn more about hospice care in the time of COVID-19, KGNU's Shelley Schlender spoke with Jen Thompson of Boulder's Trailwind Hospice.
It is an exceptional time in hospice, and there are new hurdles and new challenges every day. These patients and families are now trauma victims on top of everything else that was already going on. Not all of these patients who have COVID were expecting to be terminally ill. They may not have been anticipating that they were likely to pass away, and now they've come down with COVID, and suddenly someone in an emergency room has had an abrupt conversation with them about what their wishes are, and now suddenly they're terminally ill and going to a place where one family member can come in or no family members can come in. So what we've had to do as an agency is just adapt overnight and almost hourly into a more trauma-based mode where the predictability that we usually have the luxury of is gone, because we're going to accept people, obviously, if it's not likely that they're going to survive during this crisis. And same as we talked about, they might, they absolutely might, but it's just a whole new layer of support, the emotional needs of families that are separated and not able to be together, and how we can work around and share those messages and make people feel connected when they can't physically be with their loved ones, make them feel comfortable that we've got the situation under control, and then, you know, nurse the trauma that is this whole new layer that doesn't usually exist in hospice.
Well, Jen, there at Trailwinds Hospice, you've mentioned a whole bunch of things that have changed. One of them is, if somebody's diagnosed with COVID-19, for instance, in the hospital, people can't visit them. Does that mean that family members can't visit them?
The guidelines that have come out, both from Centers for Medicare Services, the federal guidelines, all of the recommendations state that the exception is to be made at end of life. That's really challenging for our facilities and our hospitals to work through, because that's not often clear to them. I mean, hospice are supposed to be experts at that. We guide families down that road, and we let them know when we're talking about final days and final hours and sometimes final minutes. And our partners in the community, that's not necessarily their skill set. And so we are trying to outreach to get ourselves in there and help them with that part, so that we can facilitate the adherence to those guidelines, that if someone is going to actively pass away, that a family member be able to come in and be with them.
All right. So that's one part, is that it's a case-by-case situation, whether or not, if someone has COVID-19, whether a family member would be able to go in and hold their hand. It's not a guarantee. It's something that has to be thought through. Added to that is that you in hospice, if someone has COVID-19, you can't go in there with them.
We are in there with them.
Oh, you are in there with them.
Yes, we are. So we still have a responsibility to care for our patients, including those patients we are providing care for who have COVID-19. And some of these patients are gravely ill and have significant medical needs. So if they have left the hospital setting to face COVID and the potential that they won't survive, then we are providing direct frontline care to them in their home.
How about somebody who is not in their home, somebody who is in a care facility, for instance? Are you allowed to go in to a care facility from hospice to help somebody in this time period?
Yes, hospice nurses are recognized as essential staff. The core team by Medicare has been recognized as essential staff. Now, all of us in the community are doing our part to do telemedicine everywhere it's possible, because we know that's the best way to slow the spread of the disease. So if it's not necessary, if it's a check-in visit, if people are stable, if the chaplain can provide spiritual support, via FaceTime, Skype, or some other mechanism, then that's the right answer. But as you know, when it comes to medical things, that's got to be done person to person. So our patients, we have a responsibility to, no matter where they are, to go in and physically provide the nursing care.
All right. So if it is a case where somebody is diagnosed, you all are going in to where they are to help them with the needs of hospice care.
That's correct. Be right beside their family member and help facilitate that all the way through to the point at which they pass.
That's Jen Thompson of Boulder's Trailwinds Hospice speaking with Shelley Schlender. And we'll hear an extended interview with her on how COVID-19 is changing the dying process for so many. That'll come up this Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. And this evening at 6:30 p.m. we'll be broadcasting Governor Jared Polis's speech to the state live. We're preempting outsources this evening. Now, you can catch it live at 6:30 on the radio or at kgnu.org. And don't forget, all of our coverage of the current COVID-19 crisis is online at kgnu.org. Well, in addition to hoarding toilet paper, it seems that Coloradoans are also stockpiling guns and ammunition. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation is reporting an increase of nearly 90% in requests for background checks. And that means delays in turning those around. And that is raising concerns about firearms dealers being legally allowed to sell somebody a gun without clearing a background check first. Eileen McCarron is with Colorado Ceasefire. That's a gun control advocacy group that last Friday wrote a letter to Governor Polis asking him to intervene in this situation.
So the background check system in Colorado, under federal law, if the background check has not cleared or the firearms dealer has not received word from CBI on the disposition of the background check within 3 days, the firearms dealer is free to release the firearm to the person who wanted to buy it to complete the sale. The National Sports Shooting Foundation and the CBI have asked and requested that gun dealers not do that, but that's only a request. They can't require them to not release the firearm. And so in 2019, it was an average of about 7,500 people over the year were denied buying a gun because they were prohibited buyers. They were felons. They were domestic violence abusers. They were fugitives from justice. They were adjudicated mentally ill. There are all these categories of people who are prohibited from buying guns because we know they can be dangerous. Not every single one of them, but in general, it's believed they are dangerous to society to have guns, and so they are prohibited. That's under federal law that these people are prohibited from owning firearms. Nevertheless, 7,500 of these people went in last year on average. I think it was over the last 5 years that 7,500 on average went into a gun store and tried to buy a gun and were turned down. I mean, they even knowing that they had these issues and were likely prohibited buyers, I guess they thought they'd try. So as it is now, a gun store could go ahead and release it to somebody who has a violent felony record. And they would be legal in doing so if it's after the 3 business days. The current queue, yesterday I was told the queue was 6 days for a background check. The CBI is now saying 5 days, but that's greater than the 3 days. So it's taking them longer to check because of this huge surge in gun sales. It's taking CBI longer to check than is the time frame for which they have to release the firearm. So hopefully we're sitting here praying that the gun dealers will be responsible and not release the firearm or complete the sale until they get a go-ahead from CBI. At Ceasefire, we have asked the governor to use his emergency disaster powers, which he has powers to do under state statute, to suspend the sale, dispensing, and transport of firearms during a declared disaster emergency. And we are in a declared disaster emergency, so it is within the governor's powers to intervene here. And what we're asking the governor to do is to require gun stores to not release the firearms from a sale until they have a go-ahead of a cleared background check from CBI. And as a means of enforcement on it, if there's a non-compliance of a gun dealer on this, that they could lose their status as an essential business, and therefore could have their doors closed for the duration of the disaster emergency.
Well, I know that was the subject of the letter that you wrote on Friday to Governor Polis, along with other organizations as well. I mean, it is early days and Governor Polis has been doing press conferences on Friday, but have you had any contact with his administration on this particular issue? Because it has been well reported about the increase in gun sales and the concerns being raised by domestic violence survivor advocacy groups about, you know, what could potentially happen now with all of this. Have you had any kind of an official response about any of this?
Have not. We have not had a direct communication with the governor on this. I know that the domestic violence people are very concerned and they are having their own requests of the governor. And I do have to say the governor is doing an incredible job of dealing with a very difficult situation at this time. And where our request might seem like, wow, there's so many other things to deal with, but it is a life and death. It is a safety and security risk for the people of our state that we could have felons and domestic violence abusers and others that are prohibited skirting by the laws we put in place to try to keep our community safe. So our first step was this letter to, just inform him and request that he uses emergency powers to address this issue, keep our community safe.
And Eileen, I mean, you mentioned a very important component of this around suicide and, of course, the mental health implications of what's happening right now with the current pandemic and how people are being even further isolated, literally, due to what is going on, that's a major concern. This is also a public health issue, gun violence, and yet it's very often not talked about in that context.
Correct. You know, last year we enacted the Extreme Risk Protection Order, which is a kind of a, it was dealing with mental health and other individuals who are perhaps temporarily not able to control their anger or issues. They might not be mentally ill. They might not be diagnosed as having mental illness, but that they're having dangerous tendencies. They're scaring their families with their talk of violence. That we allowed families and law enforcement to intervene in those cases with regard to guns. That was not dealing with the whole mental health issue, which there's a whole gamut of things that the mental health community is probably now quite concerned about, and perhaps depression. As a minister, assistant minister at my church said, I think there's a lot of low grade depression going on right now with all that we're facing with the COVID-19. If you did buy a gun, if you have a gun ever, but particularly if you speaking to people who have just recently purchased a firearm. If there are children in the home or prohibited users or people with having some difficulties adjusting, maybe difficulties having some emotional difficulties at any time, or ones particularly now, and we may all be sort of people having difficulties right now, that you keep those guns locked up securely, lock up the ammunition separately, and make sure that young people, children do not have the keys or the combinations or the way to get into those guns. We don't need to compound the crisis that we have in our country right now with a tragedy in a home that could have been prevented.
Eileen McCarron is with Colorado Ceasefire, one of the groups that wrote to Governor Polis last Friday asking him to declare emergency and to stop gun sellers from selling weapons without people clearing a background check. The current backlog in Colorado means that under federal law, people can purchase a weapon without having fully cleared a background check.